Welcome to MP Access, the official podcast of Mortgage Point and the Five Star Institute. My name is Gina Galusha. I'm the executive director, and today we're coming at you live from Five Star Government Forum in Washington, D.C., and we have with us Shayna Arrington. Shayna, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
We are glad you're here. Tell us a little bit about your role, your chief risk officer at ServBank. How did you get there? What do you do?
What do I do? So the easy answer is I oversee all things risk, compliance, and corporate governance at the bank. The way that I explain it to my kids is very simple. I say, I make sure the bank is following all the rules. I ensure that we are making smart decisions every day. And I make sure that our customers' money is safe. So those are kind of my three pillars as I explain it to my kids.
I can see your kids going with that and understanding it, you know, because that's kind of what you do as a mom too, right? You're following all the rules. You're doing what you're supposed to. You're making good choices, you know.
Yeah. And if you're not, I'm watching.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. How'd you get there?
So I actually started my career here in D.C., with what I call the alphabet soup of federal financial agencies. And I thought I was going to be a government attorney for life, and my husband's military. Ah. So we moved around a lot, and I ended up leaving government service, and I went to a law firm as outside counsel, still within the mortgage banking space. And I did that for several years before one of my clients talked me into coming in-house. And I've never looked back since. So went in-house as chief compliance officer and now chief risk officer at a bank.
So you really had kind of every perspective there is to have at this point, right?
I have. So regulator turned outside counsel, turned inside operator. And I got to say, in-house is my favorite. It's absolutely the most fun.
It's good that you're there. What's most fun about it?
You know, I think, and we were having this conversation today during a discussion about our partners at our regulators here in DC, it's very hard to regulate something if you've never done it. And it's easy to sit in a room and write regulations and write rules that you think will work. Mm-hmm. But if you've never had to operationalize them, you're missing a huge part of the puzzle. And so I think sitting in all of those chairs has brought me to a place where I can make smart decisions. I can work with the business to figure out what's defensible, what's within our risk levels, and then move forward with something that I feel good about.
That makes sense. It does, you know, sometimes it feels as though that sounds like a good idea, right? But in practice, it is tricky. It's much trickier than expected. So that is cool that you have all those perspectives. So what has being a former regulator done to help you in terms of how you do operate?
It definitely changes my perspective on things. I remember when I worked at HUD, I worked in their office of single family, and I worked within an office that partially oversaw the mortgagee review board. And so that's where you go if you're in trouble with HUD. And so we would only see lenders and servicers if something was wrong. And we would sit in these rooms and we would listen to their side of the story about what happened and how they got where they were. And, you know, those of us on the HUD side of the table at the time, they would, you know, walk out and we would say, is everyone out there doing nefarious things? Is anyone trying to do right by the consumer? Mm-hmm. And the answer to that, now that I'm in the industry, is absolutely. And so we kind of promised ourselves if we were ever on the other side of the table, we would be out there, we would be telling the story, we would be showing on behalf of the industry all of the good things that the industry does. Because there are incredible people in this industry. There are incredible stories, people working on behalf of our consumers every day. And so now that I'm on that side of the fence, that's exactly what I do. And so I have fostered really great relationships with our regulators, whether it's the CFPB, the FDIC, the OCC. No matter who is overseeing the shop that I'm in, that's the number one goal for me, is having a close relationship with them. I think that it's a mutual relationship. You know, a lot of times they're coming into our bank, they're learning from us. We're cutting edge on technology, on customer service. They want to see how we do things. And we're very cognizant of the fact that they are in and out of institutions all the time. And so they know how 20 other banks do it or 20 other servicers do it. And so we're constantly calling them up, asking questions. Hey, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And I find a lot of value in that relationship in a way that moves the business forward in a way that's smart and responsible.
Right. Is it difficult to maintain those relationships when you have appointments that happen every 4 years? does that change who you're talking to, or does it not change?
I think it depends on the agency, okay. And it depends on the part of the agency that you're working with. Mm-hmm. So from a supervision perspective, we tend to see less turnover in terms of our examiners, whoever your examiner in charge is, the team you're working with. Mm-hmm. From a policy perspective, that's where we see more of a change in appointees.
Right.
But I have to say that it's a small space. And so you see a lot of the same people that are coming from servicing shops, from the industry trade groups, into government service, out of government service.
Right.
And I think, you know, good people serve no matter the circumstance and no matter the company. And you'll find them in government, you'll find them in-house, and wherever they are, they're going to make an impact.
That makes sense. Because you really do see the same faces in different places, right? Because they move around. So what is exciting that's happening at SurfBank right now?
So we have a lot of exciting things happening at SurfBank right now. We actually just closed on an acquisition. So when we purchased the bank through a change of control in 2022, the bank was at about $150 million. We grew it organically to just under $1 billion. We broke $1 billion last August. And then we just purchased another bank, Iroquois Federal Savings and Loan Association, also based out of Illinois, where we're headquartered. And so combined, the institutions were just under $2 billion.
Wow.
And so we just had our legal day one early in March, and we're working towards system conversion and bringing all the customers under the SurfBank brand.
Okay. I need to pause. It's 2026. That's 4 years and immense growth. Tell us about how that growth came about. What are the drivers behind it, the philosophies behind it?
We have, I should start with we're privately owned, so we're very nimble. Mm. We have an incredible leadership team. Our owners have always believed in hiring the best talent, regardless of location. And so we're very fortunate to have a team across the country. On the servicing side of the business, our leadership team has worked together for most of our executives have been there 8 to 10 years. And so we have a very tight-knit group of executives that work very closely together and are not afraid to challenge each other and support each other. And I think that helps us accelerate our growth.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So culture in terms of leadership team. What about processes, procedures that you could put those in place so fast as you grow it to that pace, right? With that many more clients, et cetera.
One of the really interesting things for me of coming from an IMB, where I was the chief compliance officer, and then moving into a depository as chief risk officer, you would think, you know, you have the same federal financial regulators. There are 5 of them across the board, and it just depends how you're chartered and how your company's built, who regulates you. I always say the rules are the same. The regulations don't change. The laws don't change. It's just who's overseeing you changes and maybe where the area focus is.
Right.
But moving from an IMB to a depository, there is a lot on the infrastructure on the bank side that needed to be built out around our servicing division. Everything from our enterprise risk management, our model risk management, things that you don't see because they're not requirements of IMB servicers. And what's interesting now is with all of the AI infrastructure and the guidelines and the policy that's being put out there, now we have IMBs that are being looked at through that same lens, and it's almost leveling the playing field to say, if you're going to implement these AI pieces, if you're going to go to AI technology, here's your framework. And that framework is the same way that you're looking at models on the bank side of the business. So it's almost bringing it together in a way that I think levels the playing field across the board.
Hmm. Interesting. How do you view AI from the risk perspective? Where do you start?
You just start. I have to say that. And I have to give major kudos to our chief servicing officer, Jason Kwasny, who 2 to 3 years ago, we sat in a strategic meeting, and we meet every quarter as an executive team within servicing and then separately within banking to talk about what our strategy is, what our goals are, where we're heading. And he said, we absolutely have to be talking about AI. And he really pushed us as an organization, like just to start. And I think because of that, we are probably much further ahead than other servicers, than other banks that took the step back and said, we don't know it yet. It's too risky. We don't have an infrastructure for it. Let's just wait and see. We kind of jumped in and we built the infrastructure as we went.
Oh.
And as an executive team, I worked very closely with our chief information security officer to say, what do we feel comfortable with? What are we going to recommend to our board? And we started in this phased approach that has allowed us now, I think, to be leaps and bounds beyond where we would have been if we would have waited to jump in.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like your entire team is kind of using it now, comfortable with it now from top to bottom?
I'm going to say I see AI in two, maybe three buckets.
Okay.
So where we went first was personal, professional efficiencies, right? So we run on Microsoft Office 365. Copilot was our initial AI that everybody had access to. And we trained starting from our executives all the way down. And it's actually a required training. All of our new team members now, regardless of role, have to do Copilot training. And so just picking up small efficiencies on things like we don't need somebody to take meeting notes anymore, or, you know, you can create a PowerPoint deck in less than 5 minutes and it might have taken somebody an hour. And now I've gotten to the point with my teams where most of the teams that I have in risk and compliance have significantly revamped our reporting. The data is the data, but the way it looks is so much better. And the way that we can present it to our risk committee, to our board, to our executive team, that's digestible, that's easy to understand what's going on. And I've just been blown away by the team and how they've picked things up and the work product that they have created with the assistance of AI is so much better than what we had a year ago. And I'm excited about what it's going to be a year from now. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one bucket that I'm going to say on the personal productivity and just the amount of time you can save in man hours. The other piece I'm going to say is the vendor piece. And so using vendors who use AI, and there are a lot more guardrails around that. And again, like anything else, you do it responsibly. You do it in iterations. You roll out one piece at a time. Mm-hmm. You get comfortable. You get your executive team and your board comfortable, and then you try something else. And so I think that's the second path. And then maybe the third piece I'm going to say is the generative AI.
Okay.
And that's what we haven't really touched yet. And that's what I think scares people, right? The
Absolutely.
AI that thinks for itself.
Yes.
And so when you're having a conversation about AI, and especially, you know, servicing is antiquated, banking is antiquated, and a lot of people are scared about it. And so I think what you want to be scared about is the generative, and it's important to kind of look at these buckets and say, where do you start? You start with the easiest, you start with the lowest hanging fruit, and then you get to a place of comfort.
Mm-hmm. What did you find in that personal productivity that you were able to do more of because you were spending less time as a company on the little details?
Oh, I'm going to say across the organization, absolutely everything, particularly within our servicing division, we had a large push at the request of our chief servicing officer, and he really set this fantastic program into motion about allowing people to come up with their own ideas for use in a responsible and controlled way. And we had a great pilot program that really brought us a lot of time savings. But I think reporting is one. Things that were done manually before, where now you can just dump the data into a bot and we'll spit it out for you. And our call center, you know, everybody does it a little bit differently. But the question is always, how do you empower your people with this massive amount of information? And you get down to the loan level, and how do you solve a problem at the loan level when you have this huge sort of encyclopedia of knowledge behind the scene? And so being able to prompt that and produce that on demand when you need it has been incredible for us, I think, in terms of time savings, average call time. And then I think just a lot of, you know, what I always say to my team is think about what takes up your most of your time, and then figure out a way to automate it. And if you can't automate it, you're never going to be able to automate it, because that's your brain power that we need.
Right.
And there are certain things we're never going to be able to get to. Mm-hmm. But if you have a task that you don't want to do, figure out how to make the computer do it.
Right. There's someone on my team in particular that she was kind of freaked out when I was like, we're going to use this thing. And she was like, well, I feel like it's replacing me. And I said, no, it's making it so we can use the highest, you know, portion of your brain rather than the lowest, right? And so it is really empowering, that word you use. It's really empowering when you can say your time is worth more than this, right? More than kind of, I can't tell you how many times I've taken a PowerPoint and I'm like, we're going to scooch it this way, we're going to scooch it that way. You know what I'm saying? You waste so much of your life force on all of that. So that's very cool to say. And, you know, when, especially when you've got someone on the phone who's got something going on and they need support and they need help and they have questions about their biggest asset, I can see how, like you said, that average call time going down and being able to support someone sooner is really impactful.
And there are an infinite number of things that can happen on a loan of why you have a consumer calling in. And you can try to predict based on their history and what's going on with the loan of maybe why they're calling in. And of course, there are a lot of general servicing questions, and we do a really great job of training our call center team members. But there are a lot of crazy things that could happen on a loan that maybe will happen to, you know, one in 500 or one in 1,000. And to be able to know what that thing is and what the process is and how to direct the customer, you could have somebody look it up and they will eventually find it, or you could serve it up to them. And then so that saves a lot of time for us.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. You mentioned earlier that it was open to anyone in terms of how they wanted to use it as long as they followed certain guidelines. What do those guidelines look like? How did you come up with those?
Well, I will say we relied on some early movers in the space, and some of our industry trade groups put out some sort of, baseline guidance. Mm-hmm. The biggest concern for us was using closed AI, so something that was closed to our own environment.
Right.
Making sure that our team members, their devices were locked down so they could only use the types of platforms that we were blessing, that they were closed platforms. And even within that, we put in some sort of, you know, second, third, fourth layer protections of here are restrictions on things you can or cannot put into this system, just out of an absolute abundance of caution. I think we have a great responsibility in financial services to take care of our customers' information. And a lot of that was we have a technology committee, but also conversations between our executive team, between risk, between compliance, between information security, about where our comfort level was and what we felt as a team was within our risk appetite.
Mm-hmm. I'm guessing you had to do a lot of research for that too, right? In that partnership.
I did.
Hmm. Okay. Awesome. So what are other ways that you all are looking at that you can support consumers as things are starting to shift and change and we're seeing a little bit more difficulty in the market? What are you guys implementing to help support those owners?
Well, I'll say one thing about ServBank is we've always been very customer focused, and we've always been, we like to say, deeply passionate about the customer experience. Mm-hmm. And so coming from compliance, you know, you can check every single box and you can give a customer exactly what the regulations say you have to give them. And that absolutely does not mean they're going to understand it. And so I'll always say, if there's a model form that gives us safe harbor, we'll use the model form. And if there's not, we're going to customize it and we're going to make it something that makes sense. And so is it going to have exactly the information in there that a regulation or an agency guideline is telling me it has to have in there? Absolutely. Is it going to have all the required disclosures? Absolutely. But am I going to have a human on my team look at it and say, if I did not know what a forbearance was, if I did not understand loss mitigation, would this make sense to me? And is there a better way that we can write it to craft the language? And yes, maybe we have to send this via certified mail, but like, is that the best way to get to the consumer? Maybe we should also send it in an email. Maybe we should ask the consumer how they want to be communicated with. Mm-hmm. And so I think coming at it from a perspective of what makes sense, what does the consumer want? How do we help them? Not just what do we have to do? It's a different way of thinking about it. And you're going to get the product out either way. And there might be some servicers out there that they don't care about the customer experience, or, you know, all they care about is cost. And everyone has their own kind of focus. And so for us, customer experience is top of mind. And we've always kind of come at it from the customer's point of view when we're looking at something. And there are plenty of things that come across my desk, across my team's desk, and we'll say, does it hit all the marks? Is it compliant? Yes. Do I think we should send this? Absolutely not. And we go back and we fix it.
Because especially in those moments when people's cortisol levels are high, right, and their brain is in fight or flight in some ways, you need to make it simple, a simple communication that they can understand and that they feel kind of more calmed by, if that makes sense, that they're it rather than legalese where the cortisol just keeps going up. Because there are times when I read something and I'm just like, wait, no, what did that say? I read it three times. I don't know. Stresses you out, right? So that's awesome.
Yeah. And I will just add, for some of our higher volume messaging communications, we started to do FAQs that, you know, we bucket as inserts, or we put in an email for them. We've done escrow analysis guides. We've really kind of tried to break it down to say, what do people get confused about? Where can we educate the consumer and help them?
Right.
And let's be proactive about doing that.
Mm-hmm. And I think too, just making sure they know there are solutions, right? And that you're there for those solutions is huge. But the escrow analysis, man, I can't tell you how many times I've sat down with my escrow math and I'm like, y'all, what are you talking about? I don't even know.
Okay, which is amazing because you're deep in servicing. You fully understand escrow.
Yes.
And you can still look at the statement and not understand what it says and how you got there on the numbers.
Well, especially after a loan transfer. Right. That's when I was just like, y'all, this makes no sense. And so much trust was lost in that moment, which was not fair because they did have the numbers right. But the way that it was explained, the trust was gone, you know, and the escrow is now in my bank account.
Well, I will say on that point, because we are a subservicer and we do onboard and offboard a lot of loans. We have tweaked a lot of our custom forms, everything from our RESPA letter, our welcome package, our escrow analysis to say, if your loan is transferring in this or, you know, trigger the logic, if your loan is transferring out that, here's what you should know. Here's how it impacts you. Because a lot of times people don't think about that and the language might be the model language, but it might not always make sense.
Right. I love that. And that one-to-one communication forms a relationship. It really does. And it forms trust in the end of the day, which is the most important thing, right? Okay, let's talk about, we talked a little bit about cross-functional collaboration with you and the head of servicing. What other cross-functional, I would think that as the chief risk officer, that risk and you being the one who's making sure everybody's dotting the I's and crossing the T's, it could be a combative relationship, right? In some areas, we've talked about you have a really close relationship with your team. So how do you collaborate across those functions with your full leadership team to make sure that that's happening in a way that's positive?
Well, I'm going to say it is top down in terms of messaging, but also of accountability. Mm-hmm. And so we really hold all of our executives and our leadership team accountable to doing things the right way and telling us when they're not. And I would also say from the moment that we have new team members step in the door, we're really highlighting the importance of compliance and risk management within the organization and encouraging them to raise their hand if they see something too. And so we've gotten to a really great point where I would say self-reporting, self-identification is woven into the DNA of the company, where nobody's afraid to raise their hand and say they messed something up. If anybody works at a servicing shop and they're telling you that everything is perfect and it doesn't get messed up, they're absolutely lying to you because things break all the time. It's people, it's processes, it's technology. And you can have the cleanest shop in the world and things will still break. The question is, do you know when something breaks and how quickly can you fix it? And that's a superpower that we've been able to cultivate as a team where somebody says, I absolutely knew something just broke today. Or, hey, maybe I think something broke today. Can you come look at it? Mm-hmm. And then can you help me fix it? And we have executive teams, team meetings every week. And part of those meetings, we call it share and learn. And you can share something that went really well. Here's a win that my team had and here's why. Here's how we got there. Or here's a loss. Here's something we messed up and here's what we did to fix it. And it is very rare that something ever gets to that weekly meeting that has broken that doesn't already have a fix in place. And so the team is on it and we like to say, you know, things will break, but we're really good at knowing when and we're even better at fixing them quickly.
That's so cool. That has to, again, require trust, right? Because if an employee is willing to raise their hand and say, I messed up, that's a scary thing, you know? So that accountability, but in terms of responsibility rather than punishment, right?
We have on our risk reporting, on our issues management reporting, we have what I call a stacking order of how we identify issues. And we always want it to be the highest coming from the line of business and then go all the way down to outside sources. So I never want to have a regulator come in and tell me something's broken that I didn't already know about. Mm-hmm. If they tell me something's broken, I want to say, oh, I know my team found it 6 months ago and here's what we did and here's how we fixed it. And here's all the paperwork to tell the story. And that's the right way to do it.
We talked a lot about AI and how that helps a lot, but it can also create a lot of cyber risk. For instance, my kids had a bomb threat at their school thanks to AI. How that works, I still don't know. But, you know, there's a lot of risk that comes from AI that's changing, growing. So how do you approach protection from a cyber risk standpoint?
I think that historically there has been a misconception when it comes to cyber risk that it is the responsibility of the technology team. And that was probably something that held up into maybe 3 to 5 years ago. You could get by with only having your technology team, your information security team involved in everything from mitigating your cyber risk, your cyber threats to your incident response. And in today's environment, you just can't get there. And I think that the incident with Mr. Cooper a few years ago was really eye-opening to a lot of the industry, and we started to ask questions about, if this happened, would you know who to call? What's legal's role? What's compliance's role? What's risk's role? You know, do we have the phone numbers of these people saved somewhere if we can't get onto our systems? And we really came together within our institution. We had a core working group on this to say, how would we handle these things? How would we get in front of them now? And then we've been able to build out our incident response, and we kind of look at it in two buckets. We see cyber threats, and then we actually see physical threats as well within our branches, which is something that we have to work through. And within physical threats is also weather threats, depending on where we're located. And so we kind of look across that, and we've been able to come up with a working group of executives and run tabletop exercises to say, this is something that's tailored to this particular part of the business. So today, if we couldn't take payments and servicing, what would we do? If we couldn't send wires and deposit ops, what would we do? And so for us, it's been I think a really good way for our executive team to come together. And I'll never forget, we did one particularly tailored exercise. And one of our owners looked at me and said, I feel physically ill right now. And I said, you're welcome. Aren't you glad that we're doing this now? And we can think about it when nothing is wrong versus when it's an emergency. And so I think the answer for me has been getting more people involved and getting people to think about, if you were in this situation, what would you need? What can we prep? Every exercise we do, we have a takeaway, a to-do list of things that we can better prepare to get out in front of it. And so we're always kind of asking those questions. How has the environment changed? What are we seeing in other shops? And how do we not be that organization?
Do you ever feel as though your team at any point thinks, oh, are we going to say the sky is falling again? Or are we Chicken Little, that kind of thing? Or are they all saying, you know what? These things are all possibilities. So let's get engaged. Let's think about those possibilities and prepare.
I mean, the threats are out there, and it's not like they're not happening. Mm-hmm. Any financial institution is constantly getting, I'll say, actively threatened, attempted to be penetrated. And so as those actors become more knowledgeable, as they have better technology at their fingertips, as they have AI and other sort of cutting edge tools, we need to be stronger and we need to be better prepared for it. And I think it just takes the right people at the table to come up with creative solutions on how to prevent it. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the NIST framework now, it's not just how to prevent it, but when it happens, how do you respond to it? And right. That's equally as important.
And swiftly. And that comes down to what you were talking about earlier in terms of the whole team needs to be aware, right? So that they all could raise their hand in that instance, right? So other than, you know, kind of cyber risk and what's changing and shifting there and AI, what are you looking forward to? What are you looking forward toward in terms of what's coming, what you want to be happening for SurfBank, and ways that you're preparing or working towards it?
So cyber risk and AI are definitely top of mind. I would add to that third and fourth party risk. We have a pretty tight vendor management program, but now we're having to ask questions about what are our vendors doing. To the conversation we had earlier about AI, yes, you're using AI, but what type of AI? Mm-hmm. And is it open? Is it closed? What kind of information are you putting in there? What's your system retaining? And so the level that we need to dig into now to understand what is happening is much, much deeper. So that's definitely something I have my eye on. I think on the servicing front for the past, you know, 5-6 years plus COVID, the real risk on the servicing front has been compliance risk, because the regulations have been changing, the agency guidelines have been changing, sometimes weekly. And so we've had a really tight management around that. And now that I'm going to say that's settling down, and the minute I say it's settling down, we'll get new RegEx rules. So I feel like I just jinxed it. But hopefully those will help us be more efficient. But I think we've got to look to risks on other parts of the business. And what we're seeing now across the industry, and everybody seeing it, is the consolidation of servicing right. and originations yes. and real estate into yes. these verticals.
Yes.
And so I think the question for us is, how do we operate in a way that gives us longevity? Mm-hmm. How do we continue to solve problems in a way that's different from everybody else and to stand out? And how do we continue to do things in a way that is right by the customers, right by the consumers, right by our clients? And for us, that will give us the longevity that we need.
Right. That consolidation reminds me of, you know, we started the conversation with y'all just acquired, a second half. And that too comes with so much work in terms of making sure when we talk about the consolidation in the industry, you have to think about how do you make sure that it's seamless, right? That the acquisition is seamless, that files aren't lost or information isn't lost, and how do you get them into your program and that kind of thing. And we've been talking a lot about what you were talking about in terms of the vendors at the League. When you think about with that acquisition, everybody needs to be informed of what's changed, right? There's so much communication that has to happen at scale as well. So that makes total sense. Okay, last thing. What would you say to someone coming up in the industry now? Everybody says, you know, they didn't intend to go into mortgage servicing, but they somehow got wrangled into it or ended up there. What would you say about the future of mortgage servicing to someone who's coming up in it now, and how to prepare or how to grow and how to learn?
I would say that the industry is still ripe for change and innovation. Mm. It's still a space where I hear a lot of this is the way we've always done it. And I still think from, you know, what I've heard in other shops, there are a lot of inefficiencies out there. And so if you're coming up in servicing, if you're looking at getting into the industry, if you're already in the industry and you're trying mm-hmm. to figure out what's next, I would say learn as many of the functions as you can. One of the things that I was talking to somebody about this week here in DC is innovation. And they were saying to me, you know, we got our whole leadership together at this organization and we really kind of pressed people for ideas on innovation and how we're going to change processes. And he said, and I was grossly disappointed in what came out. And I said, because you asked the wrong people. You asked your mid-level managers. They're not doing the work. You need to go ask somebody who's actually correcting credit reports or filing claims or running escrow analysis. Those are the people who know the process every right. day. And those are the people you need to ask to help you make it better in a way that empowers them. And so back to what you said about AI, we're not trying to replace people. We're trying to replace the base functions that they do right. so we can use their brain power for a higher and better use. And I think that in an industry that's always done things a certain way, if we have fresh talent, if we have fresh ideas, if we have fresh technology, we can get to a much better place, mm-hmm. which ends up in a better customer experience.
Right. Yeah. The way that I talk to my team is that what if question, right? If you have an issue, I want you to be asking, what if we did it differently? How could we do it differently? What are we going to do differently? And then bring it, right? Don't be afraid to speak up, because that's how great change happens, you know?
And not every idea is going to work, but you don't know if you don't try.
Right. Or it just needs a little refinement. Just a little tweak.
I will say, though, I think with the dependence on AI, you know, anybody who's coming into the industry that already has a base knowledge set or is willing to learn and raise their hand, the teams that I have where people have said, I don't know that, but I'd like to go learn it, or I'd like the opportunity to try something. Those people have been incredibly successful and have then been able to leverage that into their next assignment or their next position within the company. It's helped them move up faster. But I also think communication, because you can be a great coder, you can be a great AI prompter, but you still need a human in the loop and you still need human strategy, at least at this point. And so I think being able to, going back to the partnership, connect between different areas of the servicing organization, they're all incredibly niche and it's a complex business. And I think being able to connect the dots between them is a great skill to have.
Absolutely. Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us today. We loved hearing from you. I loved hearing from you. There is no we in this room, but I hope you enjoyed it as well. And I hope that you enjoyed it too and learned a lot about how you can implement AI, cyber risk, and risk in general, but also collaboration and culture. Thank you, Shayna.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to MP Access. Stay up to date with daily mortgage news, featured stories, and our latest episodes of the podcast at themortgagepoint.com. Don't miss out. We'll see you next week.